Well, good evening again to all of you. I feel very low tech up here. I just have these pieces of paper that I've, like, I guess it's ink on them. I left my clay tablets at home, but I've got a whole library of them. It's amazing. Someday archaeologists will dig up my house and they'll be like, wow. Who knew that in the United States in the 21st century, people were still reading from clay tablets? The good news is I'm not on low battery mode, so you all are safe. So I thought maybe as I start off this this talk, I would introduce it by sharing a little bit about my experience. So I'm a family doctor. I graduated from my residency program in July of 2000. There were no numbers after that at that point. And I've been in practice in small towns ever since. And so in the beginning, for the first 17 years, I did inpatient medicine as well as outpatient, and I also did obstetrics. And then we moved to Virginia in 2017, and at that point I gave up OB and hospital medicine. I just do outpatient medicine. And so as I share this evening, some of the things that I'm going to share come from my experience. And it's different when you're a family doctor. So if you're in an ER and you see somebody multiple times a week, that's frustrating. And you don't develop relationship, you develop animosity towards that person. And you wonder what's wrong with the hospitalists who can't fix them, or their families who can't keep them home, or whatever's going on. But if I see somebody multiple times a week, it says I'm not doing my job and I need to figure out how I can minister to that need that's there. How do I need to get them to some place where they can get services that are going to help them forward? And also with that comes trust. You know, so, you know, when you go to the ER, you don't have any control over who you see there, who your nurse is. But when you choose a family doctor, you usually, you try to choose somebody that you have some level of trust for, or trust in, and some level of relationship with, and that tends to build over time. So, you know, after 5 years in Brookneal, maybe patients are starting to trust me a little bit. When I first got there, they didn't. They didn't know me. They trusted Dr. Jones because he'd been there for, you know, 20-odd years, and, you know, longer than that, probably closer to 40 years. And so, you know, there's that sort of level of trust that you get over time with somebody that you don't have initially. And I was thinking about healing in the name of Jesus, and the first thing that came to my mind was a lady who came in, and this is sort of thing that happened multiple times, but I just remember in particular, she was in her early 50s, and she tested positive for COVID, and this really freaked her out. She was somebody who had had a cousin die of COVID, and she was convinced that the hospital had killed her. They put her on medications that were just dangerous. And she wasn't interested in doing anything. She didn't want antibody treatments. She didn't want anything. But at the same time, she was just convinced that this was, you know, she just better reserve her monument down at the local cemetery. And so she went away a little unhappy because she didn't want treatment, but she did not want treatment either. And I think more than anything else, she just wanted assurance that things were going to be okay. And yet she didn't trust me enough to believe what I was telling her about where she was at and the assurance that I was giving her that I was going to be walking beside her through this. And people don't trust medical providers very much these days. There's a lot of reasons why they don't. Some of them are valid and some of them aren't. But it doesn't really matter, okay? So if you don't trust somebody, you don't trust them. You know, if somebody calls you up tomorrow and they sound like a computer and they offer to sell you a home security system, I have an idea of what you're going to do. And it's not buy a home security system, okay? Because that level of trust isn't there. It's just not, you know, I mean, I don't even know if you're interested in a home security system, but that's probably not where you would start. And so when people come in and they don't trust us and they're not sure about whatever diagnosis they've been given, where do we start? How do we show love to them? How do we behave to them as Jesus would and have that mind of Christ? Let's turn to Mark chapter 2. So we're going to start with this story, and in close to the end, I'm going to come back to it because I think it has a lot in it. But this is a story of Jesus healing a paralyzed man, and I think it's a pretty familiar story. And it comes from fairly early in his ministry. So we're going to start at verse 1 and read through verse 12. When he, that is Jesus, had come back to Capernaum, several days afterward it was heard that he was at home. And many were gathered together so that there was no longer room, not even near the door. And he was speaking the word to them. And they came bringing to him a paralytic carried by four men. Being unable to get to him because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him. And when they had dug out an opening, they let down the pallet on which the paralytic was lying. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." But some of the scribes were sitting there and reasoning in their hearts, "Why does this man speak that way? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone?" Immediately, Jesus, aware in his spirit that they were reasoning that way within themselves, said to them, Why are you reasoning about these things in your heart? Which is easier, to say to the paralytic, "Your sins are forgiven," or to say, "Get up and pick up your pallet and walk"? And which is easier? You know, the reality is that both are beyond our capability, right? You know, if there was a paralyzed person here, you could say either one of these things to them, but nothing would happen, right? You say, "Pick up your bed and walk," and they just lie there. And you say, "Your sins are forgiven," and you don't have any ability to forgive sins either. But Jesus is different from us, isn't he? "But so that you know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralytic, "I say to you, get up, pick up your pallet, and go home." And he got up and immediately picked up the pallet and went out in the sight of everyone, so that they were all amazed and were glorifying God, saying, "We have never seen anything like this." And I feel like over the last couple years in particular, people have really focused on the question, what would Jesus do? Would Jesus wear a mask? Would Jesus get vaccinated? Would Jesus social distance? And there's all sorts of other things. And people basically decide what they think they're going to do, and then they say, "Well, Jesus would do this," right? And I think that's a reasonable way to go. But maybe it's not the best question to ask. Because what Jesus would do in a situation is not what we can do in that situation, okay? So if Jesus saw a person with COVID, he would just heal the person with COVID. But you can't do that, and I can't either. We are limited, and he was unlimited, in a way that we aren't. And so when we look at this story, we see Jesus doing things that we can't do. We can't forgive sins. We can't read people's minds. I mean, it probably wasn't too hard to read the Pharisees' minds here. You know, they pretty clear. They had probably grumpy looks on their faces, and Jesus knew they were thinking that he was being blasphemous. But still, he could read their minds. He knew what they were thinking. And more than that, he was able to heal instantaneously. So, you know, if somebody came in and had a situation where they were paralyzed from some surgically fixable thing, and you went in and you fixed it, it's still going to take years, months of rehab to get them back to the place where they can pick up a bed and walk off with it. And yet Jesus was able to do that just like that. He had capabilities that we don't have. And so, you know, what would Jesus do? Well, Jesus would do what you can't do. And yet, the question that is better to ask maybe is something like, how would Jesus treat somebody like this? How would he respond to somebody who is treating him like this patient is treating me now? How can I reveal Jesus to this person? And it almost seems like in this situation that Jesus was healing this man as an afterthought. The important thing was the sins and this man's forgiveness. And it was just, you know, he says, "Well, so that you know that I have the power to forgive sins, I'm going to heal this person." And maybe the point there is that whatever we do, God needs to be glorified in it. This was about Jesus pointing to the Father and saying, God has sent me. I am doing his will. And because of that, I'm able to do things that I couldn't do on my own. John 4:46-54, I'm not going to read that, but it tells a story about a nobleman who comes to Jesus and asks for healing for his son. And, you know, you think about this story, and the thing that stands out to me about this story is the fact that it says at the end of this that this was a second miracle that Jesus had done. Okay, so the first miracle we know is turning water into wine. That's not going to give anybody a clue that you have the ability to heal people, right? Why did this nobleman come to Jesus? Because he was desperate. He had no other options. He didn't know what to do. He loved his son. He loved him so much that he was going to go see this quack preacher who was out there who he thought maybe, just maybe, could help his son. And so often when people come to see us, they're desperate. They need something. And the question is, can we offer that? Luke 4:17-21. This is a story of Jesus in the synagogue. And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." And it's easy to spiritualize Jesus' ministry. He was setting captives free from sin. He was preaching to give sight to eyes blinded by sin. But the reality was that he ministered to the physical needs of the people in his time, which were many. And I often think, you know, Palestine in Jesus' day was much worse than even third world countries today. The people were in desperate need. They were oppressed. They were poor. Such doctors as they had weren't very good doctors, right? So somebody had brought up the fact that Luke is very good at, I think it was Micah maybe, Luke was very good at documenting the things about people's ailments. And he was, you know, but he also had a little bit of a soft spot for doctors. And you see it in the one story. Luke says about the woman who had an issue of blood, he says, you know, this woman spent all her money on doctors and she wasn't any better. And Mark says, this woman spent all her living on doctors and not only was she not better, she was worse. So the doctors didn't help her. They actually made the situation worse. And you don't know what they were doing. You know, we know that George Washington, when he got pneumonia at the end of his life, his doctors bled him, I believe, 5 different times. 40% of his blood volume was drained off of him, and they only stopped because they didn't think he could tolerate another bleeding. And so, you know, medical science has come a little ways since then. We only take enough to run blood tests. But in Jesus' day, doctors didn't really know what they were doing. And I think sometimes these days we don't know as much as we think we do. But we have come a little ways. The fact that we are Christ followers should make a difference in the ways in which we minister to the needs of our patients. Colossians 3:17 says, "Whatever you do, in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father." And I'm not always sure what that looks like. So there are plenty of people in this world who are nice people. They're not Christians, but they treat people with respect, they say nice things to them, they're willing to do good things. We call this altruism, right? Altruism is just a big word that means that you're willing to do something without some kind of a return. You know, so, you know, there's people that go out and donate blood, they're volunteering in hospitals, and it's not necessarily because they're Christians. They're just they're just nice people, and they maybe they feel like they've been given something, and they're willing to give back. So to me, it starts with compassion. John 11:35 is the shortest verse in the King James. It may be longer in other versions, but it says Jesus wept. And I think we all know this verse because it's so short. So this was maybe one of the first verses I memorized because, you know, if you had to say a Bible memory verse, it was just really easy to say this one and you're just done. But this simple statement came when Jesus was at the tomb of Lazarus. He'd spoken with Mary and with Martha, and he talked to them about the resurrection. And both of them saw the resurrection as something that was coming later. Resurrection, yes, we know we'll see our brother again. Yes, we know he's in God's hands now, but we still miss him desperately. And they identified Jesus as coming too late. Jesus, you came to this situation too late. If you had come earlier, this would be different. Lazarus would be healed. We would be a family again. We just don't know how we're going to go on. Single women didn't do so well in those days. And so they depended on Lazarus. And yet Jesus knew the outcome of the situation. He knew that he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead. And so why did he weep? Why did he cry whenever he was standing outside this tomb? Well, the Jewish people that were standing there said, oh, how he loved him. He loved Lazarus so much, he was just weeping because he just missed his dear friend. But we know that that's not really what it was. He was going to take care of the situation. But I think we see here a demonstration of Jesus' compassion. Jesus saw the raw emotions of the people around him. He saw their unbelief. He saw their lack and the things that only he could meet. And he cried for this. We know that he had compassion. And this is a love and empathy that Jesus showed for us when we were lost in sin. He saw us, he saw our needs, and he wanted to minister to those needs. Matthew 23, verse 37, he was talking about Jerusalem here. He says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones, those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. And I think sometimes our patients are in this very same situation. We see the changes that need to happen in their lives so that they can receive some kind of healing, and they are not willing. I remember in my training seeing a patient who had been admitted so many times for pancreatitis. He was an alcoholic. And each time he'd get admitted, he'd commit himself to being sober. He was going to do things differently. He got admitted to detox situations. And when I was a second year, he got admitted to the hospital. And this time it was different. He was bleeding from alcoholic gastropathy. Called in the GI guys. They scoped him. They couldn't get things stopped. We gave him FFP. We gave him all the different things we could. And he went into a coma, and his parents came in. He was in his mid-30s, and they just sat at his bedside. And I sat there. I was a second-year resident, and I didn't have answers. I hadn't really taken care of a lot of patients that were dying, and I just cried with them because I didn't have answers. And they were losing a son. This was somebody who was just really important to them, and they knew what needed to change in his life, and they hadn't been able to bring that change about. And I'm sure they had prayed for it many times, and it just hadn't happened. It was his fault that he died. He'd made bad choices. He had gone down a path of sin. But it didn't change the loss. It didn't change the emptiness that his parents felt afterwards. And it told me something. Each person is valuable to God and needs to be valuable to us too. And if we can just gently push people in the right direction to make better choices for themselves, maybe we can be a start of some change. Matthew 9:36 says, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And I don't do hospital medicine now, but I can remember when I was in a small town and it was holiday time, and it just seemed like that was the time when everybody got admitted to the hospital. I remember one Christmas, and we had an ER doctor who was just really, like, he would go upstairs. We only had 25 beds, and he would just count the number of beds that were available. And then he would just fill them up. And I came in, and I was the only doctor on that weekend. And I had 19 patients to see. And I just decided, you know, I am not discharging a single person, because if I discharge somebody, he's just going to admit somebody else. You all are staying. Ha! Merry Christmas. And that wasn't really, like, very nice of me. I mean, I don't know. Maybe some of them could have gone home. But I also realized that, you know, those people didn't want to be in the hospital on Christmas. And their families, most of them didn't want them in the hospital on Christmas. Now, sometimes, you know, we'd have these people who, like, you know, they just really did want to get their grandma out of the house so they could do more fun things on Christmas. And, you know, so they dropped them off at the ER. But I think it's important to remember that compassion is going to inspire us to do something, something good in other people's lives. In Jesus' case, when he had compassion, he ministered to people. He brought healing. He spoke truth. I had mentioned compassion fatigue in my last talk, and I just really think that a lot of us have battled this over the last couple of years. And often compassion fatigue even comes with an individual patient. If you've taken care of a patient too much and they have just not done what they should for themselves, it's easy to kind of, you know, your compassion reservoir starts running dry. You know, each one of us is maybe a little bit like a lemon, and we're full of juice at the beginning of the shift or whatever, and we just get squeezed out a little bit too much, and finally there's just not much left in there but the seeds. And the next patient who comes along, they don't know that we've been squeezed out. They have no idea, but they find out pretty quickly, don't they? So what does compassion look like in the real world? The first thing is that it begins with listening. So I was at a talk last year, and it was a medical education conference, and there was a talk about adverse events of childhood, or they called them AECs. And it turns out that if you've had enough bad things happen to you as a child or adolescent, it's going to affect not only your emotional health, but also your physical health too. So people with high scores for this have higher rates of cancer, heart disease, and strokes. And the speaker said, you know, maybe instead of asking people what's wrong with you, we should instead ask the question, what happened to you? Because everyone has a story. And I never really have time to do this. I have a certain number of things to cover. I have a certain amount of things that I have to cover in an office visit, and I just have to get through them. You know, I have to know how their sugars are doing and whether they're tolerating their blood pressure medicine and do they want a flu shot. And what they really want to tell me is about how their brother died of cancer last week and about how their dad isn't doing well and their mom has dementia and they're trying to care for them and this is just stressing them out. And if I take care of all the numbers in their chart and send them away and they haven't been able to share those things that are really important to them, I have not succeeded. And yet hospital administrators don't care about that stuff, do they? They don't really care if you listen or not. I mean, they do in a sense. So they send out surveys to our patients, and, you know, if the patients give us bad scores, then, you know, then they know that. But they don't. You know, their concern is what, you know, does Dr. Waldron have good blood pressure control on his patients? How are their A1Cs down there at Brookneal? I think listening is simply sitting down and looking at a person, hearing what they're saying, and speaking it back to them. And our body language is going to tell them whether our heart is in it. So what are the biggest impediments to this? Well, time, I mentioned that. It just seems like none of us have enough time. We have to get through our days. We have a certain level of charting that has to be done. And this isn't the only person we're going to take care of during the day either. Maybe this second thing is that we see the person is having self-inflicted problems. So they smoke, they use alcohol or have substance abuse problems, and this stress in their life is self-inflicted. And a lot of people have self-inflicted stress. You know, they just don't live in such a way that they're going to have stress-free lives. Maybe we're just simply tired out. I think the last couple of years have been hard, but you know, people struggled with burnout before COVID. That's not a new thing. And you know, if we're more tired now than we were before and feel more misunderstood, it's still something that is real. So how do we overcome these impediments? Well, first of all, obviously just take time. You know, figure out how to take a couple minutes and just sit down and listen to somebody. And sit down. You know, I think that's really important. I hate this because I am invariably going out of the door and my patient says, oh, by the way, and I've got my hand on the door knob and I'm thinking, you know, I'll just stay here for a while and they'll be quicker. And they say, I've been trying to lose weight and I'm like, oh, you know, I should really just make them come back and schedule an office visit for that because it takes a long time. But the compassionate thing is to sit back down and listen to them and try to give some input. I think it's important to understand that this patient is like us and needs Jesus. So each one of us needs Jesus, don't we? And maybe that patient isn't willing to admit that, but hopefully the time will come when they are. I had a patient that I took care of back when I still did deliveries, and she had problems with substance abuse. And her family tried to get through to her, I tried to get through to her, and I just remember when she was pregnant with her fifth child, she came into the hospital high on meth and labor. She was too early for our hospital, and we transferred her out. And her baby spent some considerable time in the NICU as a result. And she went to prison over it. And by God's grace, she's a different person today. She is a Christian now, and she has left drugs behind her. And it wasn't because of me. I think there were some things that changed whenever she was in prison. I think that really made her hit bottom. But each one of us can push people in the right direction just a little bit. And maybe we're not the final person on that chain that brings them to redemption, but we can help. And every person on that chain is equally important. So the last person who spoke to her in prison and the light went off is just as important as the first person who just tried to speak Jesus into her life. I think it's really helpful to picture Jesus across from you. How would you treat Jesus if he was sitting in that seat? What would you say to him? How would you talk to him? Matthew 25:40 says, truly I say to you, as you did to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. And I think it will lead us to have sympathy at least. I'm not very good at empathy. We talked about this a little bit in our small group. Empathy is where you try to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. Sympathy is just feeling sorry for them. And I think it's important that the patient understands that you are trying to understand where they're at and you're walking beside them on their journey. And then compassion is about kindness too. It's about thinking what the right thing is to say and saying it in a way that is not hurtful. Speak the truth gently but truthfully. John 4:16-18, this is Jesus speaking to the Samaritan woman. Jesus said to her, go call your husband and come here. The woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you are right in saying I have no husband. for you've had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you've said is true. The Samaritan woman was a hurting soul. We don't know what was wrong with her, why five husbands had divorced her. You know, maybe she had fertility issues. Maybe she just hadn't been able to have children, and this, you know, just had made her distant. Maybe, you know, maybe she had other issues. But the reality was she was at the well by herself. When most women went to the well in groups, she had had multiple husbands. She was alone and lonely, and Jesus spoke truth to her. And we know that Jesus offered her living water. This was his entry into dialogue with her. And so often, tone is everything. When I ask my children to do something, they can say, yes, Dad, in a couple different ways, right? They can say, yes, Dad. Or they can say, yes, Dad. Or probably there's probably 10 other different ways that they could say that. And based on that, I'm going to identify if they're cheerfully doing what I'm asking them to do, or if they're just, you know, not even sure if they're going to do it or not. I think it's really important that we communicate that we're on the same team. I think a lot of times patients question our motives. Why are we doing the things that we're doing? Are we taking payments from Big Pharma on the side? I don't, but maybe you all do. You should be clear to patients if you're getting payments from drug companies. I tell my patients, and I really do tell them this, I say, I'm the point guard on the team, and you are shooting. And even if you mess up the shot three times in a row, I'm going to keep passing you the ball. We are on the same team, and I'm not going to get mad at you because you miss a shot. Wherever you're at today is where you're at today, and we're going to go forward. And if people understand that, if they understand that they're not letting you down because they let themselves down, it helps. If I get mad at my patients when they come in to see me, you know what happens? They just stop coming in. They don't want to have somebody, you know, yell at them every time they come in because they haven't lost weight. But at the same time, you know, I am going to tell them the truth. I'm going to tell them what's, you know, what they're doing wrong and what they're doing right. And I think that's really important. Ephesians 4:15 says, rather speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. And maybe this, you know, truth in love is a little bit like what Micah was saying about truth and grace. I really like this verse because it combines two very important things, truth, speaking, and love. And I'm afraid that these days a lot of people think they have the gift of prophecy. And you know, what does it mean when you have the gift of prophecy? It just means you can say mean things to people and claim the Spirit's leading. It's a very beneficial gift for everybody except the people you're speaking to. And before we jump into telling people about all the things that they're doing wrong, we need to communicate a message of love and care. We care about them, and that's why we're saying this. And people need to feel loved. They seldom do when you're bringing up things that got them into the shape that they're in. I really struggle with this, like when I'm talking to people about weight loss. And I was talking to a lady not so long ago, and I said, I really hate to bring this up, but you know, you really do need to lose some weight. And she said, you know, Dr. Waldron, thank you for bringing that up. I know I do. And, you know, fat people are people too. And we know we need to lose weight. It's just the challenge is doing it. And we talked about different things that could maybe help her some, and I offered to give a referral to somebody who might be able to help her more than I could. But I think that if I'd said that in a different way, that could have just broken the relationship and she just decided not to come back again. And that's not great. We need to be genuine. So people can sense when we're fake. I had an administrator who worked with me and she's just always just almost like fake, like like artificially positive. I don't know. It's like drinking drinks with saccharin in them. You know, it's just really, you know. Anyway, I don't even know what to say except that, you know, I just, like, I'd rather she just said, you know, you're doing a good job. I appreciate you. But you know, it's got to be like over the top positive. And it just doesn't feel real to me. And maybe that's just the way that she is. But you need to be genuine. If you're not somebody who cries a lot, don't feel like you need to cry with patients. That's, you know. But if somebody tells you something that really moves you, it's okay to shed some tears with them. That's okay too. You know, we weep with the people who weep, and we are positive with the people who have done something good. Be present. Let your patients know that you will be with them on their journey. So this may be just to the end of your shift, and you can tell them when that's going to be over. It can be years, as you know. I mean, when I'm working in Brookneal, I don't know how many years I have left, but you know, I'm not planning to, you know, whatever decisions my patients make, I'm going to try to help them along. I think it's appropriate to use physical touch. You don't. You know, you have to be careful with that sort of thing. And obviously, you know, we think about infections, but, you know, it's appropriate to touch them on their arm or take their hand, something like that. It lets them know that you care. I had a psychiatrist once who told me that he got into psychiatry because you didn't have to touch the patients. And I thought, you know, mental health patients often are the ones who need physical touch the most. They just really, they're needy people. So I had a patient that I think about in this kind of a scenario because she was a really hard patient. She's actually a current patient of mine, and I'll call her Bobby. And she was struggling with COPD. She's still smoking a pack a day. I sent her to a pulmonologist because she wasn't breathing very well, and her PFTs were awful. And she got mad. She said, "You know, look at my jaw." I just looked at it, it looked normal to me. Said, "Look at my overbite. Can you imagine trying to blow into a PFT machine with this kind of an overbite?" It's like, I'm there with you. And she said, "You know, the doctors around here are just awful." She said, your clinic, the doctors here are terrible. You're okay, but you're the best of the worst, you know, I don't know. And I mean, I wasn't even sure. I guess she was seeing me because I was the best of the worst. And I mean, she was just smarter than all of her doctors. Everything that we did just wasn't good enough. And she said at one visit, she said, "I just hope you're not one of those religious doctors who tries to pray with their patients." I said, "Well, you know, actually I am, but I usually ask permission first, so I probably won't be doing that with you." And she said, "Well, I hope not." You know, I came to the conclusion she just was smarter than all her doctors. If you're smarter than your doctor, you need a different doctor. Or you just need to come to a realization that, you know, maybe you're not as smart as you think. But she shared with me one day that her fear was of dying. She didn't have a relationship with Jesus. She didn't know him at all. And when COVID came, it was just terrible for her. She was afraid she was going to get COVID and she was going to die. And that was all there was to it. And she still struggles. You know, I can't say things are better. Her anxiety is still hard. Her lungs aren't better than they were. But she does trust me a little bit more today than she did a couple years ago. And most people who don't like Christians have had some kind of a negative experience from someone who claimed to be a follower of Jesus in the past. They have known somebody who claimed to be a Christian and just didn't treat them well. And maybe that was in the healthcare environment, maybe it wasn't. But when we meet them, they distrust us as a result. And when people are angry, it's often growing out of a feeling of fear. And maybe we can't take that fear away. I was just thinking a little bit about this. You know, how do we deal with angry patients? And I mean, just a couple things that come to mind don't don't let your anger rise in response. So, you know, maybe you have justification for being angry with them. They're not treating you appropriately. Don't get angry with them. Don't take it personally. They're often not angry with you. They're angry with the situation. They're angry with somebody who, you know, on the last shift who did something just really dumb, and you're feeling the brunt of it. Listen more than you talk, and repeat their concerns back to them in your own words. So I have never gotten angry with a patient, even when I had the right to do that, where I felt good about it afterwards. It just doesn't, it never helps the situation. And how do you deal with anxiety? I think building trust is the important thing there, and letting people know that you're going to walk beside them. Give them hope if you can. I mean, if somebody is really, really sick and you think that they're not going to get better, don't give them false hope, but still try to give them hope and let them know that they're not alone. Listen to the Spirit. We're not going to read it. John 14, 23 through 27. Jesus talks about the Spirit coming. And what's the Spirit going to do? He's going to bring peace and he's going to bring comfort. And I like the idea of peace coming here. So often we're worried about what we're going to say and if we might cause more turmoil and chaos by speaking the wrong words. But if we're listening to the Spirit, our words are going to bring comfort and they're going to bring peace. And that's a blessing. And we're going to have that peace first. The Spirit speaks peace into our lives. As we speak, we are comfortable knowing that we are not speaking of ourselves. We're speaking for somebody else, and he's more important. And I do think this is a promise. I don't think Jesus said this to his disciples because he was just trying to get them through the trauma of his death. I think it was more than that. Praying with patience. So this is something I do quite frequently. I don't do it with everybody, so, you know, somebody comes in with bronchitis, probably just going to see them for bronchitis and give them an inhaler and maybe an antibiotic if it's warranted and send them on their ways. But there's a lot of time that people come in for other things. I remember a year ago last Christmas, and I had a lady who came in who was talking to me, and she was just really struggling with COVID. She was healthy. But she just felt like she couldn't be around family. They didn't want her around. It was just her and her husband. And in talking to her a little bit more, she turned out that she'd had a daughter who passed from sickle cell. And she just started crying and telling me about how much her daughter had suffered and about how strong her daughter had been and about how this time of year, holidays, she just really missed her. And now with COVID and not getting together with families, it just was even harder. And I didn't know what to do, and I just said, you know, can we pray together? And I just prayed for her and for her situation. And at the end, she said, thank you. I just really needed that prayer right then. And she didn't come in for that. She didn't even mean to share all those kinds of things. She just came in for a well checkup and to get renewals on her prescriptions. But I think that the Spirit moves whenever we need to spend those times. Always ask first. I mean, if somebody doesn't want to be prayed for, don't pray for them. It's okay. But a lot of people are willing to, even if they're not somebody who is a Christian, they're willing to have you speak some words for them. You can offer to pray for patients, and this is a hard thing. I don't think you should offer to pray for patients if you're not going to do it, okay? So, you know, I mean, people say that all the time, oh, I'll be praying for you, and I never know what they mean. Are they really going to? Are they not? I mean, if don't bother saying it if you're not going to do it. I mean, if you're somebody who has a notebook with like 80 people in it that you've told them that you're going to pray for them and you hardly ever open it, then, you know, but it is a nice thing to say to people if you're going to actually do it. So, speak words of encouragement. Ephesians 4, 29 and 30 says, let there be no more foul language, but good words instead, words suitable for the occasion which God can use to help other people. Never hurt the Holy Spirit. He is, remember, the personal pledge of your eventual full redemption. And 1 Thessalonians 5:11 says, therefore encourage one another and build one another up just as you are doing. And to me, encouragement can be a couple different things. First of all, it can be telling somebody that they're doing a good job and keep on doing what they're doing. So maybe this is a mother who looks worn out and you just say, you know, you're doing a good job. You're a good mom. And that can mean a lot. Maybe it's somebody who has diabetes who's kind of, not doing quite as well. And you say, you know, I think you're doing better than you think. And it also can mean telling somebody that they have potential in a particular area. So we can do this with children, with coworkers. You know, I remember when I was a first-year medical student, I'm sorry, first-year resident, one of my attendings told me, you know, you should do OB in practice, he told me. And I hadn't really been thinking about doing that until that moment. And when he said that, I was like, oh, wow, you know, I have some particular talent. Maybe I should spend more time doing this. And I did for quite a while. Barnabas means son of encouragement. And we don't know exactly what this means, but we do know that Barnabas went and got Paul and got him started on his missionary journeys. And we also know that he gave John Mark a second chance when Paul wasn't willing to do so. And I'm afraid that Anabaptists aren't always good at giving encouragement. You know, we're afraid of making people proud and pumping people up. You know, maybe we've known enough people with narcissism that we're just thinking, you know, we're just going to create narcissists. We just say too many good things about them. You know, and maybe, you know, if you've got surgeons that you know, you probably don't need to tell the surgeons that they do a good job. But other than, you know, surgeons are a separate category, but anybody else, feel comfortable giving them a little word of recognition. I had a patient last week who came in and he said, you know, Dr. Waldron, I just want to tell you, everybody says good things about you, and I don't know who everybody is, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, it made me feel good. Sometimes patients will give me a card, and it's, you know, a positive card, not like, you know, a farewell card. And it makes me feel better. I keep those because I think every one of us has down days when we need those kinds of words. And you never know when somebody is at that moment and you can speak a little bit of encouragement into their life. And don't make stuff up, obviously. I said before, speak truth. So I'm going to come back around to the story that we looked at earlier from Mark chapter 2. I was thinking about the story in John where there's the invalid man by the pool of Bethesda. You all remember that story. And, you know, Jesus came by there and he said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, my friends dropped me off here. I don't know if he said his friends dropped him off here, but obviously somebody had to. I mean, he had to get to the pool. And there's healing in the pool, but I'm just so slow that by the time everybody else, you know, by the time the water is done troubled, I don't get in the pool in time. And so Jesus healed him, right? And I thought about that because, you know, what kind of friends were these friends? You know, it's like, you know, dropping somebody off in the ER parking lot and, you know, hoping that they make it to the ER entrance. But, you know, maybe it's the bare minimum. You're just like, okay, well, you know, we're going to try to help you get healing. You know, try to get in the pool today because, you know, you never know when the pool's going to be troubled again. You're not going to be bothered to help the man out. But in Mark chapter 2, we read that, and there are different groups of people here. And I ask you this evening, which member of this are you? And I'm afraid I've been in every single one of these groups probably at different points. Are you part of the crowd that blocks the way for the man who needs to meet the master? So there's a whole crowd of people in the way. The man cannot get through to Jesus. Are we part of that crowd that's actually impeding our patients from seeing Jesus? Are you part of the criticizing Pharisees who identifies the problems in that man's life? Are you the paralyzed man who desperately needs healing but can't get there on his own? Are you one of the bearers of the cot, doing everything you can to get somebody else to the master? Or do you see yourself as Jesus, providing the healing for other people around you? And probably at different points, you see yourself in different positions in this story. I think more often than not, we are the cot bearers, the people who are trying to get sick, hurting, paralyzed people through to the one person that can heal them. And the most important thing for our patients is that they see Jesus, that they meet him. And maybe the only time that they will see that is in our faces. The only time they will feel that is in our handshakes.